Hey, everybody. Welcome to DLC, the show that stands for Jeff Cannata is still on his honeymoon. But don't worry, Christian Spicer here holding it down. And boy, oh boy, do we have one heck of a show planned for you. We've got stuff and other stuff, and then there's going to be some stuff and also video. No, it's going to be a great show. Joining me, first-timer DLC. So excited to have him on the show. We've tried before and schedules just didn't work out. Amazing improviser. Bunch of shows at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater. Part of the improv and sketch group White Women. Also does shows at Social Tron Live, doing some video game stuff. Joining me for the first time, the man, the legend, the myth, the best hugger who ever has given me a hug outside of UCB, Iffy Wadiway. Iffy, what's up, buddy?
Hey, how's it going? That's such a great intro. Thank you.
You're a good hugger, so I couldn't leave that out, right?
Yeah, I gotta give those good hugs because that's how people remember you. It's like, oh, that was a good hug.
Yeah, especially when how tall are you, Iffy?
6'1".
6'1", and like how buff are you? What do you bench? I don't know how to. I'm a skinny guy. I don't know how to say this. How buff are you?
I think I'm like half a Terry Crews.
Okay, that's tough. And joining me as well, returning guest, always a pleasure to have him on the show. We first started podcasting together back on Shack News and Weekend Confirmed, now serving as the feature content director over at joystick.com, the lovely, the talented, the Canadian, Zab D'Amatos. Zab, what's
up? It always comes back to being Canadian. It's good. I feel like I should have hugged you more, and then I would have got a longer intro.
Oh, okay, let me... the nicest guy to have never given me a hug after a podcast. The most pleasant person in which to pass spit into a microphone with, Zab D'Amatos.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for both being here. I think the last time we did a show, Zab, in person, I think we were sharing a mic over on at Weekend Confirmed. So it's nice to be on Skype with you again and each have our own mics.
Yeah. I think that was the exit episode for that show.
Yeah, it was a long it's crazy how fast that goes by. This is episode 42 of DLC, which means something to people that read and understand The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. To me, it means we're 10 away from a year, which is insane. And you've been at Joystick for 2 years, 3 years?
Collectively, it's been close to 5 or 6, but
no, you don't get to do it. It's not like you and your girlfriend break up and then get back together. You don't count all of that.
So it'll be 2 years. It'll actually have been over 2 years now.
Okay. Yeah. That's crazy. Well, you keep putting out great stuff over there. So I'm excited to have you on the show. It's going to be fun. DLC, of course, listener feedback and calls and your suggestions for stories of the week are always taken into account. If you are listening live right now, next week's show, you can use the hashtag DLCSOTW for something you want us to talk about. And if you are listening live right now and able to, you are able to call in to the show. It's at 512-518-5714. Again, that is 512-518-5714. We'll be taking some of your calls as well. Of course, though, how our show always starts is with story of the week. Hey, it's the story of the week. Jeff, when do you come back, buddy? When? I can't sing these bumpers. Story of the week is the part of the show where we try to convince each other of what the most important story in gaming this week is. I feel like maybe it's a little light week in terms of news as the avalanche of releases are coming our way. But there's still some fun stuff to talk about. Iffy, as a first timer, you get to go first. What is your story of the week?
I think the story of the week that has been on here that I'm looking at, I think it has to be Visceral says that Battlefield Hardline will work at launch. Because I'm a big Battlefield fan. Like, I was a big Call of Duty guy, especially like when Modern Warfare came out. Like, do we remember that? Like, when that was like the first time you were like using guns in a modern setting. And And then 2 came out, and that was fun. But then Battlefield Bad Company 2 won me over, and I've always fought hard for them. But since 4, it's been hard to take their side. And
it's been a hard line, some might say.
Yeah, it's been a hard line. And I played the beta, and it was kind of unplayable for me. I was like, this looks so bad, plays so bad, but it was so far in the future. You know, I mean, so far before the game actually came out that I was like, okay, well, this could get better. But now they're saying, like, don't worry, guys, it will work. It's like, oh, this doesn't look good.
You're right. Especially for a game, you know, Battlefield Hardline already received a little bit of a delay. But I just love the fact that it's news that a game that you're going to pay $60 for will work when it comes out. Like, what? You shouldn't have to say that. Like, Zav, you've been through enough launches and review codes of games and dealing with that. Like, what's your take on this? Well, one, do you think this game will, in fact, quote unquote, work when it comes out? And two, do we need to be told that? Isn't that crazy?
I mean, I would be shocked if they weren't trying real hard to make sure that it worked. But I mean, they put the time in it. They've delayed it. So that's good. At least they're not trying to push it out in October like they did with the previous games to try to just compete with Call of Duty. But the mere fact that they have to tell you, like, oh, by the way, this game you're going to buy, it's totally going to work, guys. They internally know that there's a perception out there that whatever they're going to release is going to be bunk, because they've dealt with this, not with just Battlefield, but like SimCity's had a problem. They're getting a lot of flack for NHL 15 that came out that has like half the features on next gen that it does on previous gen. They're about to relaunch NBA Live again.
Yeah, right.
Because
sure.
The first time they did it, it was a disaster after canceling 2 iterations of that series. They're in a weird spot now. I feel like that company is... they know that people out there expect their stuff not to work, so they kind of have to come out and say, like, no, we're putting the time in. But any single issue that comes up when that game comes up is going to hit them twice as hard as it would pretty much any other developer. Because Destiny has gone down once in a while, but it's been a pretty steady launch for a game that's sold quite well. I mean, Activision and Bungie, they've done a pretty good job with that. There's some people who will probably have issues, but it's not as widespread as a Battlefield, which I think now works. Battlefield 4 might work now. So right. If you're interested in playing Battlefield, it might work today, but for like 6 months, it didn't work properly. So yeah, that is, it's hilarious that that has to be said, but their track record says that they need to put the time in, and there's going to be people who are skeptical.
Yeah, Iffy, to what extent do you think this is, you know, Zav brought it up, you know, EA's had some larger problems in terms of both online game launches and then, of course, other, you know, quote unquote scandals or you know, people, gamers getting upset with things EA is doing. How much do you think Battlefield being an EA game affects its credibility with people assuming it's going to work, or was that damage done just by the Battlefield 4 franchise already? Or do you think having that big EA logo makes people a little more apprehensive than they would otherwise be?
I'd say it'd be about 50-50 because, yeah, definitely EA has just, you know, muddied its name. Like, they might as well just, you know, do a relaunch as a new company because everyone
hates
them.
They come back
as
A&E. Oh, wait.
Yeah. But, like... also, it's just the proof is in the pudding. It's just all the other Battlefields were so bad. And it is because I think you said it perfectly, where it's just the fact that, you know, they're trying to keep up with Call of Duty because now Call of Duty and Battlefield are the new sports games. You know, like they want to come out with a new one every year. But I remember where Call of Duty would come out like every few years and not just like have to be pumped out. It was like, here's some new stuff.
Yeah. I mean, we've all certainly talked about the, you know, annualization of these big franchises and pretty much of any franchise, right? Because these companies are in it to make money and the big franchises make them the money. And you see Assassin's Creed coming out every year and a Call of Duty coming out every year and a Battlefield coming out every year. And the, you know, the studios have given development duties to different studio, or the publisher has given development duties to different studios to try to make this happen, with, you know, the first example being Infinity Ward and Treyarch and the Call of Duty, and now, You have Visceral jumping into the battlefield to, you know, give DICE a break. So hopefully these games can come out and be a little more polished. Zav, in your expert opinion, no, I mean, is the annualization a problem, or does the different developers help alleviate that and help keep things, you know, should we expect them to be good? One, should we expect them to be good even if it was the same developer? Or two, do you have faith that now this is a Visceral game and DICE is working on whatever's next, that there's a better chance that it will be functioning because hopefully they've had more time with it, question mark?
I mean, Visceral may be working on this game as at its, you know, core team, but DICE has to be working on it with them. Visceral has never made a game that includes this much network capability or requirement. You know, a Battlefield game is very different from, you know, Dead Space having an online mode.
Sure.
So I don't think that I think DICE is definitely working with them. And also they're probably gonna have to work with them to make sure that they don't have this, they don't run into the same problems. In terms of annualization, it drives me crazy. I mean, the thing that I don't like about it is that I like that there's multiple teams working on it, so there's a different perspective. But if you look at Call of Duty specifically, there might be a great idea in a Call of Duty game that you love, like diving was one of those ideas for a long time, or sliding. But then the next team that's working on the next game, they're already in the middle of their development. So those great ideas don't get implemented. Ghosts was a good example. With Black Ops 2, it had a branching storyline. You can actually affect the single player and get different endings. And I thought that that was, although the story wasn't very good, I thought that it was an interesting mechanic. But because Ghost was already well in development, none of those ideas made it into that next game. So you do get this idea of steps forward and steps backwards with Call of Duty. And like Assassin's Creed, you brought it up. There are two Assassin's Creed games coming out this year.
Yeah, that's crazy.
It's too much. And this was a series that if you go back a ways, because they've gone through a lot of like creative directors, one of their creative directors after Assassin's Creed 2 said, I don't think it's right for this series to be annualized. He no longer works at Ubisoft. But, so maybe he was the holdout. But it does drive me a little crazy because it's not just the technology gets sort of reused and you get to see all the same sort of hiccups, but the creativity goes away. I mean, I want there to be a little bit more passion in these projects, and the people who work on them certainly like the games they're working on, I'm sure. But for me, if I'm playing the same franchise every single year, you're going to have to give me a reason to do that other than, oh, well, you like playing online and you'll probably buy it anyway. I need more. And yeah, those games don't do it for me.
Yeah, I think there's something to be said. And again, it's tough because, you know, these companies do want to make money, and these games, many of these games continue to be the top sellers of the year. But I really love that wanting something, that feeling of wanting something and being excited for it and wanting it to come back so badly that then when you get it and it lives up to your expectations, or you're just so excited to be back in a world. And with the annualized franchises like this, you just never really get to experience that. I feel like if the game comes out, you kind of blast your way through it, and then you gobble up, you know, one or two of the DLC packs to get ready for the next one, because you're always, you know, trying to stay fresh and stay hungry. Like, I think one of the best things to happen to the Arkham series, the Batman games, is this next one getting delayed a little bit, because now I want it. Whereas if it had hit its original release date and been another annual franchise, I think it almost would have felt too soon. Or like Mortal Kombat. Like, I feel like it's been a nice length of time since the last Mortal Kombat to this one. We're now, and I know we had an Injustice in between, but it's like, let's let things die down for a little bit, and then let's let that fever pitch come up where we're ready to play a game. I mean, there's a reason why Half-Life 3 gets mentioned so much, right? It's because it was rumored way long ago and it's been... What's up?
It's snake oil, you know, might... Sorry, I was just saying that Half-Life 3 is sort of snake oil at this point. It's something that people say will exist one day, or it will save, you know, Valve's, you know, PC market, which doesn't need saving. People talk about how Half-Life is so important, but obviously it's never... It doesn't exist anyone. Well, like, no one is working on that game.
Very interesting. Yeah, because I think like now Half-Life 3 is in this place where it's like, if it does come out, it has so much to live up to because there's just been this build up.
But isn't that better? isn't that better to have a game like that than it is to just know that the next Assassin's Creed is going to be the next Assassin's Creed? Like, that's my vote. I want that hype. I want that buildup. I want that expectation, and I want a game to live up to it or fall woefully short rather right. than I know exactly what I'm getting again.
I think Naughty Dog does it really right with the Uncharted franchise. Every single time they show off Uncharted, you're excited to play it because it's not every year. It's every couple of years, and you remember those characters. You get nostalgic for those experiences, and then you want to get you want to get invested in the series again. But if Naughty Dog released an Uncharted game every year, it would die out for you. You'd get burnt out on that series. And that's kind of what happened with me with Batman. Origin, you know, pretty much killed it for me. I'm excited for what Rocksteady is going to work on next. But, you know, if Rocksteady could have made that game in a year, it would have come out a year later. I mean, the reason why that game didn't come out is because they gave it to Ubisoft, or not Ubisoft, Warner Brothers Montreal to work on Origins. To say, like, okay, well, we need another one out this year. So put it right. out, and while they go work on the real one. So, I mean, that's sort of what happens with the Call of Duties and Assassin's Creed game. Like, if you look at the development list of the teams that work on Assassin's Creed, like, Assassin's Creed employs 92% of all of Ubisoft. Like, every studio under the moon that Ubisoft runs works on those games. I mean, it just must be so daunting for them to work on pieces of a game. So sometimes some of it feels really, you know, stifled. Like, sometimes you're one part of the game feels really fresh and innovative, and then you get to another part where it's like, why does this feel so weird? It's because it was, you know, made, that one little piece was made by a totally different team. So sometimes that poses a problem as well.
Yeah. Space Bob in the chat says, it's funny, we say we hate annualized titles, but they sell, in all caps, like hotcakes. And yeah. You know, that's true. I think, and I wrote back, it's kind of like the Transformers movies. It's easy for people to say they don't like things and they wish they would quit being like that or quit making them. But then when we keep buying them and supporting them, the companies are kind of like, okay, say whatever you want, vocal minority. we are cashing these checks all the way to the bank. Zav, what is your story of the week?
My story of the week has to do with Destiny and the this bug that leaked the expansion mission names and descriptions early for the DLC that's coming out for Destiny, which sort of started this entire conversation about, and this has also been going on Reddit, and so this is sort of two stories at the same time, of all of the story elements that were ripped out of Destiny. Now, I know you've talked about the story of Destiny. I think everyone's talked about the story. Everyone's talked about the story of Destiny so much that, you know, they realized that there was actually no story to discuss whatsoever.
Right, right.
And I know you've mentioned this too, Joseph Staten, who left Bungie after many years, who was in charge of basically Halo and that Halo Bible and was one of the main guys in terms of Destiny's story, had left Bungie quite a while ago, now works at Microsoft. And it sounds like, based on a lot of these leaks and all these other and all of the docs and all the other information they gave us when they announced the game, a lot was ripped out of that game's story, which is not surprising if you've played Destiny.
Yeah, Iffy, have you been following this story at all? Is this a rabbit hole that you dove into?
No, actually, I didn't. I play a little Destiny, but I have not even looked into this bug. I've been following just kind of the loot cave news because that has been more entertaining to me, but this is pretty crazy.
Yeah, well, it's maybe best to stay with the loot caves, but I'm ready to dive deep on this, Zav. It's one of those things where it's like, follow the money, or you know what I mean? Like, get Activision gutted, Bungie knows better. And there's all sorts of allegations slinging around on, you know, it started off on a Reddit thread, and now there's a very long NeoGAF thread. And I'm not trying to discredit or make light of, you know, what could be called strong accusations as to, you know, the planning of this game and what happened and when it happened and why it happened in terms of monetization for DLC or just trying to hit an actual release date or conflicts within the studio, you know, what the game should be, what it could be, what Bungie had described it as, where, you know, mentions of you can explore the whole solar system and then the game comes out and it's like, well, there's three planets and a moon. And then the leaked DLC, it looks like some of that content is on the disc. I mean, Zav, can Destiny catch a break? Does this matter? Will this affect Destiny 2 or Destiny DLC or continued Destiny sales? I feel like Destiny Press has been, it's been getting a beating, and then you see the commercial they have out right now, and a friend actually texted me who's been waiting and hasn't picked it up yet, and he's like, hey, I thought you said, you know, kind of mixed reviews. I saw a commercial, and it looks like everybody loves it. And I don't know if you guys have seen that commercial, but it's like, you know, it does the critics are raving, and it shows like all these 90s and all these great quotes. And then if you look at the websites they're coming from, while they might be wonderful websites, they're not very well-known websites. And it just feels like, why did you need to include that in your commercial, Bungie and or Activision? WordPress.com loves it. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah, I don't. It's a really strange situation with Destiny because I feel like Bungie's a pretty proud company in terms of the products they release. And this was their biggest game. They talked about how it was going to be the most expansive. They spent a lot of money, a lot of Activision's money, on technology to make it work. But I was there when they announced, when they first revealed the game a couple of years ago, I think now. And the way that it was described is very much not like the way that the game came out. I don't remember them going over specific story beats, which is what this quote-unquote leak is about, or what this Reddit thread is about.
Yeah.
But one of the things that Joseph Staten, he was still there at the time, talked about was, this is going to be a game where you're going to go out and explore, and then you're going to be in the middle of this massive battle, and all of a sudden, you know, a couple of your friends are going to show up, and then you're going to instantly be paired up, and now you're in a fire team. Doesn't work like that in the game. You have to go through a bunch of clunky menus. You have to, there's all this back end stuff that you have to do. And that might be a UI issue on the consoles themselves, but it's not as seamless as they made it seem. People certainly exist in the game, but doesn't work the same way. And guys, the enemy is called darkness. The main thing is the traveler. You are our guardian. It sounds like a 12-year-old wrote this game.
Is that bad? I mean, I don't know. I kind of like that stuff where it's broad nouns and, but the problem is that it doesn't then dive deep, right? Because not saying Star Wars is the best story ever, but right, there's the Jedi, there's the Sith, there's, you know what I mean? Like, you have that type of nouning
sure,
of things
Jedi
in other stories.
And Sith. But Jedi and Sith are identifiable. If I say guardian to you, that is not an identifiable thing to this franchise. The thing that Microsoft did really well with Halo was they identified the Master Chief character as a marketable character, someone that people want to become. This game has been marketed as like, you are this guardian, and by the way, everyone else is too, so don't tell anyone. Like, it's the you know, there's no identity to it. It feels like you're all fighting this, you're the most important person in the world. It's like every time you go to talk to the council member in the tower who gives you this information, you walk in and you have this cutscene where he talks about how you were very important and your ghost has selected you. And you realize, like, man, everyone who walks in this door, you're going to tell them the exact same thing. I feel like I'm being cheated on here. Like, there's no identity to it.
That's the larger problem of, you know, an MMO / millions of people playing at the same time more than, I don't know. I think,
well,
don't get me wrong. Again, I think Destiny has lots of problems. And I think some of this new stuff in terms of story that was ripped out or DLC being on the disc, like, I think these are interesting things that are worth discussing and worth critiquing. But that type of element where you're the most important person, but everyone's the most important person, I feel like that's just the difference between a game like Destiny or World of Warcraft versus Uncharted, where you're the only person playing as Drake in this single player narrative, and therefore you feel that importance. I mean, do you have examples of, well, like, how could this game make you feel like you're the most important person at the same time you and I are both playing the same game together at the same time? I mean, I think it'd be weird if it's just like, you are very important. Zav, however, is slightly more important.
Well, the thing that World of Warcraft does that I think works out really well is, you know, you have it based on the race and classes that you select. And there's a different narrative that is woven through your experience based on those selections. You get to pick to be, you know, one of the robot dudes or human or awoken, who in the game is like this really cool, very like laid back and very fierce race of people, and then you could just be an Awoken, and you know, nothing, none of that applies to you. Everyone has the exact same story. Everyone has the exact same experience. So that's one way they could have differentiated it between each player, is to give them a little bit more of their own choice, or a little bit more of that customization to make it seem like the game was more tailor-made for you and your experience.
Well, yeah, that's what I think the problem is, and maybe is this quote-unquote gutting of the story, is that, I think the big broad picture of a Watcher and the Darkness and, you know, the Guardian, I think that works, but that only works when you're able to then dive into details that make those things individual units within that larger noun, that larger group, feel unique, but then somehow related, right? So going back to Star Wars, you have the Jedi, but Mace Windu is very different than Yoda. They share similarities. They use lightsabers. They use the Force. They're on the light side of the Force, blah, blah, blah. But each one's characteristic, right, and the way they handle problem solving is different using those same traits. And I feel like what Destiny got to is that sameness, and then never broke down differences, even among the classes that are there between, you know, the warlock and who you're able to pick. It's like, oh, my grenades are different and my double jump is different. But I think if they had been story, and Kanata's thing, you know, when we last debated this, was lore versus story. And I think if they were able to break out either lore or story that made these classes and enemy types feel unique and different, then I think that goes a long way in terms of building a world that then feels less empty. And I hope they continue to build on it. But at this point, it seems like with the leaked DLC, it doesn't look like, you know, the DLC will be filling in any of these story gaps. It's just a couple more missions and another strike and another raid and keep on keeping on. So I think if you're disappointed with Destiny, I think you're going to keep being disappointed with Destiny. The good news is Forza Horizon 2 is coming out. Shadow of Mordor is coming out. Smash is coming out.
Well, I will say that I'm disappointed in the narrative of Destiny, but I still play it quite a lot. And in fact, you know, Joystick, our review of it was quite positive, because in terms of the story, you know, there are some people who won't have a major issue with the way that they've structured it. And that was certainly the case with our review. It was more about how fun the gameplay is. And I do think that the gameplay is fun. And when you have a team together, it is a lot of fun to go out and, you know, look for engrams and do some of the strike missions. It can be very challenging and very entertaining. I just wish that, and actually, if you go and look at the Grimoire, which is the app where you unlock story beats, if you read some of that story, it actually fleshes out the world quite well. I just wish that was in the game. I mean, if you want a good Destiny story, it is available to you because you can read about it. But none of it is in the game.
And fans on Reddit have created an even a better story that fills in the blanks like they did with Mass Effect 3. But ultimately, that's poor storytelling, right? if you need to seek it out. I want to take a call really quick and get someone's opinion on what they think their story of the week is. This is a call coming in from 607. You are on the air. What's your name? Where are you calling from? And what do you think the story of the week is?
Hey guys, my name is Jeff. I'm from Rochester, New York. I'm actually Space Bob in the chat. I think my story of the week would be the Steam curation pages that launched, I think, late last week. I think it's a really good step forward to help, try and bring the stuff that's like way in the background for games, you know, to the forefront. That, you know, help Steam's problem, you know, that their newly released tab to help them solve that. But I thought Jeff Gerson from Giant Bomb brought up a good point on Twitter that he doesn't know how much time he would want to devote as, as a gaming media person to fix Steam's problem, when it probably really isn't going to drive that much traffic back to his site. Maybe doing something like Amazon does, is that they can get a cut of each sale if the person, you know, clicks through their Steam curation page to actually purchase the game. It might be a unique solution going forward as well.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Steam curation, we missed it on last show, and I think it is a big deal. I think at the end there, that can of worms you started to open about maybe sites getting kickbacks for their curation pages to sales of games. I mean, hashtag Gamergate would continue, I think, if something like that. Not that, sites shouldn't make money for putting out content, but I think it could get interesting if they're getting, in my personal opinion, if sites were getting money off of sales, off of games that they were curating, but yet how is that different than some sites listing, you know, deals and then having Amazon links to buy those games and then those links being those sites' affiliate links, so therefore they're making money off of those also. I think it's a can of worms that, you know, it's an interesting one and one that, for better or worse, will be opened and worked out. Iffy, I know you are sitting on a nice PC tower right now. As a gamer that delves into the world of PCs, do you think Steam curation is something that will work, that'll help make games on Steam easier to find, or is it just another place for people to get lost not gaming?
I mean, I think just the nature of Steam and users of Steam, the Steam users will find a way to make this a way to troll certain games, but it'll be interesting to see. Like, it would work, but kind of it was interesting with the whole kickback, no money kickback. That would make it a little, you know, crazy if people were actually getting money for linking to sites. But also, just Steam has always been kind of stingy and weird with their money. You know, like, if you want a refund for a Steam game, you can't get it. You credit. And like, if you make money through like Steam trades, like, that's still Steam money. Like, all money that you put into Steam is theirs and they never pick it back. So like, I expected, you know, them not to pay anyone for curation, because that's just their one, like, Valve is the untouchable company, but their one flaw is whenever it actually comes to dealing with money. And I love Valve. I mean, I have Steam right here and I buy all my games through Steam, but I do have to know, like, all right, well, if this doesn't work out for me, I'm screwed, you know, versus like, I play Battlefield on Origin. I actually bought Battlefield 4 and got a refund within 24 hours because that's how long it took me to figure out that I did not want to play that game ever again.
Okay, well, you just lost credibility in my eyes by saying Origin is better. Never talk bad about Steam, Iffy. You're off the show. Get out of here. I thought what you were going to say is you're talking about how Valve is, you know, they control all the money and they have all the money. And then you said, I love money.
I love that money. Give me money.
Yeah. Zav, do you think curation, you know, this will work and this will help? Or I'm on the kind of the side of the fence where this is just another page for me to get lost in, and or who do I trust to curate for me? And then how do I seek these people out? And like, okay, so CheapyD at Cheapass Gamer, like, you know, they have a curation page. Like, is that what I'm going to look to? Or like, do I go to Joysticks page? Or to me, I almost feel like this is another layer of crap for me to wade through before I get to what I want. But I'm also, like both of you and most of our listeners, pretty informed gamer. So I've never really had a problem on Steam per se. Mm-hmm. Do you think this is something, Zav, that'll help the common gamer or even, you know, the more informed gamer, or what's your take on the curation?
I feel like curation is just a really fancy way of them renaming recommendations, which you could have done for a really long time. It just makes it more visible for sites to say, hey, this is what we recommend. Now, if it came back to like kickbacks for sales, I mean, I know a lot of sites would not participate in that because it's just not something we would want to be involved with. But Valve's not doing that, so that's not the problem. So I feel like it's an interesting theory. I do agree with Jeff, though, Jeff Gerstmann, who said that, you know, being tasked with, you know, fixing the problem of Steam. And the problem with Steam is there's so many games that new things that might be like a great independent game or even a great AAA game gets pushed off the front page because some new piece of DLC for a train simulator came out or something. You know, these things happen all the time. And so there is going to be scenarios where you think, okay, well, I really trust the opinion of a Joystick, or, you know, I know Total Biscuit has a really involved page there as well. And you'll say, well, what are they playing? What should I look to buy? But in the end, I think most of the sales for Steam are going to come from every single sale that they do. You know, every time 50 cents, I don't have to tell you to go buy something that's $4 on Steam. Everyone's just going to go buy it because it's $4 on Steam. Like, right. That's how Steam sales usually work. So I don't know. It's interesting. I do feel like they're trying to put a Band-Aid on a gaping wound at this point, because it is such a problem to get visibility. It's like when the iOS market exploded And it was impossible to find good games because all the stuff that was surfaced to the top was special promotions or, you know, things that had paid advertising. But the thing that I think is a little strange about it is that it surfaces based on followers. So Total Biscuit, for example, has the most followers for all the curation pages. So right. his page is always going to be the most visible. So what does that solve in the end? In the end, it's just, you know, here are the top five visible pages that likely won't change for quite some time because they have the most followers. So you just run into the same issue of here is another list of stuff to look at. And I don't know that solves any problem.
As Space Bob has another great comment, you know, it's obviously harkens back to the Watchmen, but who curates the curators? If it is purely on number of follows, then you're just perpetuating the popularity that already exists, and not necessarily a popularity contest, but it's like Total Biscuit. There's some great stuff out there, really great stuff. Very popular and deserved. So now curators is just, oh, this is what Total Biscuit thinks. And how do I get to find the person whose taste I might like that also has a young daughter and really likes video games, but doesn't have enough time to play them? You know what I mean? Like diving into that. And, It's almost the problem of too much success and being too popular, right? Where like every game wants to be on Steam because that's where most PC game sales happen. And because of that, now you're jockeying for position to be visible on that storefront. And I guess that's still better in many companies' minds than launching outside of Steam. I know that there was a pushback. Maybe it was a year ago. It kind of started getting some notoriety where games were launching with, you know, not on Steam, like F Steam. We're launching at mygame.com or whatever, and it's interesting.
I mean the so on Joystick we talked to a lot of the top curators, including Total Biscuit, about this because another issue that came up was how do you ensure that the curation wasn't based on paid advertising. So for example, like Total Biscuit actually removed, I think, or decided not to put some games on there that he had paid, not sponsorships, but he had done like paid advertising that he was very clear about in his YouTube channel. And he put it on his curation page because he liked the game. But then there was this idea of like, well, did you put it because you liked it or because it was paid from before? So he just said, you know what, I'm just going to not include that stuff now. So I think that was really fair and really wise of him to do that. So that can pose an issue as well for some people. So, I mean, that can be problematic. But again, like you said, when those people are the most visible at all times, for us, for Joystick, we only put things on our list that we really enjoy. Look at the stuff that we really enjoy. There's a link to a review. So if you already read Joystick and you look at our reviews, you already know what we enjoy. So it's just another page of like, hey, this is the stuff that we reviewed and we liked a lot. So this is what we recommend you buy because we reviewed it and we liked it a lot. You know, it doesn't serve a purpose for us, really.
Except that you're there because it serves some purpose, right? And maybe you'll quit seeing sites having these because it's almost like the new social media networking site where it's like, this seems ultimately pointless, but at the same time, we can't be the only ones without one of these. So, you know, we need to go create a curator's page too because, you know, maybe in my curator bio, I'll have a link to my shows where people can come see me live. This, you know, retail over and over and over again. And it's just like, ooh.
But again, when there's only like a handful of people who are the top visible curators, unless people go and specifically search out for your page or my page or any outlet's page that's not on that top five or top 10 list, how much traffic is honestly going to come from that? And it's not just a matter of traffic. It's just like, hey, if you follow Joystick and you happen to be on our Steam group, this is stuff that we like. You can go out. We're sort of adding to it in terms of, you know, these are things that we enjoy and here's the reason why we enjoy it. Here are our reviews and you can read about it. But for us, it's not going to drive traffic. That's for sure.
Joystick becomes the number one website in the world, thanking the success to the Steam curator page.
Yeah, I don't know how that's going to happen. I will say that that one of the commenters, Space Bob, did say that he doesn't see any difference between getting a kickback on the sale and a Steam curation than game advertising on a website. And that is a huge difference, though, because you're talking about an ad department that will buy an ad for a specific site for an extended period of time. And we're not pushing the game to sell well and we're not pushing and we're not changing our editorial opinion or something on this game because it advertises on our website. There have been plenty of examples of us advertising games that our ad department did, which is separate from editorial, that we ended up reviewing badly because we didn't like. Not that the review was bad, but the game got a bad review. You know, phrasing, I suppose. But, you know, there's plenty of examples of going both ways. So, I mean, it's a difference. If I'm getting a kickback and you know, Company X says, we will give you, you know, on every sale, we'll give you $2 on every sale. And if we start saying, like, you need to buy this game because every time you buy it, we get some money. Very different from an ad buy, just buying space on our website to advertise something. And they that's one thing from a different department that's completely separate from editorial. This is a list of curated games from our editorial team, which we are not getting money from. So that's a huge difference.
That makes sense. I do think, like I said, it's not there yet, but I, you know, as the world of commerce and not editorial is not quite the same thing, but, you know, Total Biscuit pointed out on his Twitter about how in order, it seemed like for him, and he was hearing from other people, if you wanted to get a PC, an early PC code for Shadow of Mordor, you needed to agree to a larger paid sponsorship campaign for that game. And it is, it's this weird world we're in where, like, kind of like the old days of radio and maybe still going on with payola to have your song played in certain hours and played during the most rotation because you hear it enough, you'll start to like it. And people are looking for ways to get their game in front of people. And, you know, as shady as it can often be, you have to understand at its core, Mark from marketing would understand what they're doing, whether it's right or wrong. My story of the week, and I would love to get Iffy and Zev, your guys' take on this before we move into the playlist. And then Jeff will be closing out our show with another awesome pre-recorded tabletop time. So tabletop fans, hang tight. Look forward to that. We have another awesome pre-recorded Jeff Cannata tabletop time segment coming up. Xbox One officially launches in China. To me, I think that's kind of a huge deal. China has officially, air quote around officially, had a ban on console sales in the country for, what was like 14 years. And now consoles are entering the market. Apparently, you know, they were concerned, they being not Xbox, but Chinese government allowing this stuff to happen. You know, we're shying away from, regulators were wary of violent content. So the launch lineup are games like Forza 5, Power Stone Golf, Zoo Tycoon, Naughty Kitties, which is exclusive to the region right now, I believe, Trials Fusion and stuff like that. But anytime I think a console, granted there has been gray market and black market sales of these consoles in the countries for years. If you wanted to get one, they were very easy to get, apparently. But official sales coming into a country with a huge population and, you know, a demand for the product, right? Otherwise, there wouldn't be gray and black market sales of something that people have no interest in. Do you guys think, Iffy, do you think an Xbox One launch and the expansion of these consoles into China, like this is a game changer for console gaming going forward, or is it just another territory in which these consoles will be available?
I think, yeah, no matter what market, it won't be necessarily a game changer. And I think, especially after a ban that long, there still will probably be some apprehensiveness to it. So it's not like it's going to blow up right away. And based on what, you know, the Xbox, how the Xbox One did in Japan, I can assume that China may react the same way and wait, hold out for the PS4. But, you know, who am I to say, you know, this, I'm looking now at this Naughty Kitties game. there's a cat holding an AK-47. So, I mean, well, who knows? That might be a big bringer. You know, everybody everybody might rush to grab their Xbox One so they can play with this cat.
It's interesting. I don't know. I feel like, and I could be totally ignorant here and totally wrong, I feel like to some extent, you know, the Xbox One's lack of support, and before that, the Xbox and the Xbox 360 in Japan, I think is more akin to it being obviously a Western console from a Western company, but also going into the territory in the country where the PS4 and Nintendo and the Wii U are from and built. And I wonder if a country like China will have that same allegiance to, you know, Western versus Eastern, because, okay, we are closer to Japan than the United States, and you know, geography and in some culture, but otherwise, you know, they don't. I don't know if they have a pony in the race per se. Like they're not. Well, they're probably making all of the consoles. I'm not sure where the current crop of consoles are made, but a lot of electronics do come out of China. But it's not as if the company's home base is in China. And I don't know, Zav, do you think Microsoft and Xbox will face the same stigma that they face in Japan and in China? Or do you think the Chinese will be more open to gaming on a quote-unquote Western machine?
I think there's such a hunger in the region for entertainment of this type that has been non-existent for almost two decades, that I don't think that that really matters. I mean, it's different when you're talking about Japan, because those are Japanese companies releasing Japanese products. And there's an affinity for those brands in that region. There's no affinity for any brand really of this type in China other than the importers. So if someone wants to get into video gaming and this is an available option to them that's legal and doesn't have to deal with a lot of importing, which could come with its share of issues, this might not be a problem. What I think is a bigger issue, though, is the rampant piracy rate in China, which in 2012, a report on ZNET said that it was at an all-time low, which was 77%.
Wow.
Whereas the rest of the world's piracy rate is at like 40%. And this was 2012, so it's probably changed a little bit. But that's always been a concern for manufacturers and distributors throughout any entertainment, is the piracy rate in China. So do I think Microsoft's going to clean house? Are they going to start? Are they going to become the biggest name in Chinese households? Probably not. A lot of the stuff that's included in the Xbox One, I'm assuming, doesn't work the same way. I don't know that I can use your Bing search to, you know, China still does have a restriction on a lot of their internet search stuff. And, you know, there's a lot of that that is not going to be included as well. So I don't know. It's an interesting machine to release in a region where they don't have a lot of access to things like your Netflix or your Hulu, or if you're in Europe, like Sky TV or things like that. It's purely a gaming machine. But that being said, cats holding AK-47 seems pretty sweet to me.
So I mean, who can deny a cat with an AK-47?
Selling thing in China. I think actually the Xbox One is manufactured in Mexico, if I'm not mistaken, and Brazil, because there was a report a long time ago that the reason why the Xbox One was much cheaper in Brazil than the PS4 was because there is a tariff that has to be paid in Brazil if you do not manufacture there. And I think the PS4 was like $1,000 or something ridiculous in Brazil, whereas the Xbox One was much cheaper because it was actually built there.
Yeah, that's crazy. Well, the Xbox One certainly still is not cheap in China. But talking about cats with AK-47s, that's a game. Here comes a forced transition, if there ever was one. That's a game I would like to play. Tell me, Iffy, what games are you playing?
Currently, I've been playing lots of Dota 2, lots of Counter-Strike Go. Like, I got Counter-Strike Go maybe a month ago. I've already logged in like about 95 hours into it. And I've just kind of just been bouncing around with oldies. Like, I haven't played Portal 2, but it was on sale for $5 last weekend. And I picked that up, and I beat the co-op with my friend last night. And looking forward to going into, and I'm actually replaying Half-Life 2 again, speaking of Half-Life 3.
So you are the perfect example of what Zav was talking about of Steam. It doesn't matter what's curated. Portal 2 is great. It's been out for a while. It's $5. I will be the first to say that MOBAs, I am MOBA ignorant, right? I listen to enough video game podcasts that I can fake a little bit of the lingo, but I am largely MOBA ignorant. What, if he drew you into Dota 2, and what do you find most satisfying with the game, and what is your maybe biggest complaint? I feel like oftentimes for people that love and play MOBAs a lot, we rarely hear their critiques of the game, and I'm curious, you know, what drove you in to play the game and why you love it? And then if you could change one thing about it, what would you change?
Cool. Great question. I used to play League, and I actually wanted to get a group of UCB guys together to just play MOBAs. Look, it just showed one of the guys we know are playing right now. And I wanted to get together and get everyone to play League. And then one of our friends was like, oh, no, I play Dota 2 now. We should get everyone to play Dota. And so now I basically had to convince all of these like League players to like want to play Dota. And we've all been playing Dota 2. And I think one of the biggest draws in the way that I was able to convince them to come over is like with League of Legends, you basically use the free player rotation unless you buy like the starter pack to get like the 20 original champions or like you earn, you know, the in-game currency and buy champions. But in Dota 2, all of the heroes are available from the start. It's free and all the heroes are available. And the only thing you would pay for is just like, just different, cosmetic items.
But are any of the heroes a cat holding an AK-47?
No cats held an AK-47. See, that sounds more like a League character right there. And so like, that's what kind of drew me into it is I had a chance to like, you know, play around with more characters at the time and learn about them. And I also just, I feel like it's because you can deny in Dota 2, which is like killing your own units or towers too. And I felt that added an extra strategic element to it. And so that's what drew me to it. But if I had to change anything with Dota, I'd probably say, I'd like them to lower a few of the prices for like their in-game cosmetic stuff. Like for a in-game screensaver, it's like $5. It's like, which I think is insane. And also just, I feel like they have a better community. Like it's not as toxic as League, but also just the matchmaking is so weird. Like you'll be playing with like a team of pros and then they'll give you like some people who just picked up the game. Like their matchmaking is weird.
Interesting. I mean, so as a converted League player, not to start, I mean, this is the debate that will never end. Maybe until Heroes of the Storm comes out and that's all people play. As a converted League player now to Dota, I mean, do you have any regrets? Do you wish that you could have talked your friends into playing League, or are you happy with your changeover to Dota? Is Dota your MOBA of choice now, or is it just you're playing there because that's where your friends are?
I'm just actually currently playing there till Heroes of the Storm comes out, the one where I'm going to just go all in, hit the ground floor running, and just try and like get real good at that because, you know, you got all these pros already on on Dota. Like, it's like, I want to be, because, you know, whenever there's a new game, there's that guy who's kind of good, but he's the quote unquote pro because the pros haven't really just mastered it yet. But like for those first few months, he's that dude. And that's who I want to be for those first few months. And then after, I'll go back into my cave.
Yeah, that's me. That's called betas for me. Modern Warfare. When Call of Duty came out and Modern Warfare and that beta, I was so good. And Destiny beta, oh, watch out. When like only a few people are able to play a game, like if I had a Heroes alpha code right now, I would be so good. Then when people that are actually good get into it, I'm like, when's the next beta?
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting. You probably talked about this last week with Titan getting canceled at Blizzard. That I thought was really funny because a lot of people were saying, well, you know, the MMO space has changed. And I think, yeah, it's changed into the MOBA space. Like that is where the money is now. And no one's making MMOs the way that they were when World of Warcraft was World of Warcraft, when 12 million people were playing that game. It's funny, you go to E3 this last year and every third appointment we had was for a new MOBA.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
Everything
this one's different,
is a MOBA.
Though, because it's a MOBA.
Yeah, this one's slightly different because the camera is slightly lower to the ground, so it feels like a third-person game, but it's a MOBA.
It's a MOBA.
Did you guys see that MOBA for the it's going to be for the iPad, but they also like were showing it off for the iPhone 6?
No. What is it?
It's a new MOBA, and it's specifically for the iPad and the iPhone 6, and it was – I was looking at their trailer and it was so ridiculous. Like it was like they hired the person who created the trailer. Like they gave him basically a rundown of like MOBAs and like the current tournaments. And he's like, I got this, because basically let me tell you what happens in this commercial. So there's this kid sitting alone playing like a League of Legends, it seems like, on his computer, and he hears a thumping on his wall and he's like, huh? Now he leaves his dark, lonely room and goes into the room next door where this thumping is coming from. And it's this wild, crazy party where they're playing a MOBA on their iPads and people are behind them cheering them on. It's like a rap video in there. And like, of course, dubstep is playing in the background of this commercial. And like they're just tapping, and it looks so uncomfortable to play because they're tapping on their iPads to try and move around and do attacks. But then it pans over to, you guessed it, Korea, and these pro Korean players are playing against these kids in this party, and they lose to the Korean players, and they're like congratulating themselves in Korea. And then it pans back, and then it's like, oh guys, it's the one. And this white kid comes in with his satchel and whips out his iPad, and they play. And he wrecks the whole Korean team, and they're just sad, and everyone's cheering this guy on, and dubstep drops, and it's just crazy. Let me see. I'll post it in chat if I find it, but it was ridiculous.
Yeah, this is the perfect time to drop your Twitter handle, Iffy, and then people, I'm assuming you'll tweet it when you find it. Real quick, what's your Twitter handle for the people?
Oh, it's at Iffy's Not Funny, the @IFYSNOT funny.
Awesome. Well, while you dive into that link, Mr. D'Amatos, what are you playing?
We talked a little bit about Destiny, but I also played Disney Infinity 2 Marvel Super Heroes for review on Joystick. You can read that review. I thought it was a lot of fun. I tried to, they did send me every single toy in order to play it, but I focused the review on the starter kit because it costs $75, and I feel like that's a pretty big investment for people. So it would be, yeah, it's kind of unfair for me to just go play everything that came with it. So I did try out everything, but I focused my attention on that starter kit. And I think it's really fun. It's very casual. It can be very easy if you're playing with people who aren't really great at games, or kids who I guess will master that stuff pretty quickly, and you can increase difficulty. So I think it was a little fun. There's some fun to be had there. If you're looking for a really intricate action game, it's a lot of go there. It's actually very MMO-esque. Go to this location, beat up dudes, or go to this location and collect things. And if you find dudes there, beat them up, or go and get someone because dudes are going to try to beat them up. And if you find those dudes, try to go beat them up. Like, it's very simple, but I thought it was a lot of fun. One thing actually I didn't put in this document for us to talk about that I wanted to mention briefly is I actually went to the Oculus trade show that happened last week and got to experience the new Oculus prototype.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, let's dive into that.
So ooh, it is very impressive. For the first time ever in my experience playing Oculus, I was actually able to stand up, because ordinarily they make you sit down and you're holding a controller to play an experience. Like, I've played Eve Valkyrie, which is the dogfighting game, space dogfighting game, for example, or I've played Alien Isolation with Oculus, which sadly is not actually a game that's coming out for it, but it would be amazing if that were the case. But Crescent Bay is absolutely stunning. Like, the graphical fidelity in the screen, they've been working with Samsung to get like a really high quality OLED screen. They haven't said the resolution of it. They're not talking about that stuff. But a lot of different experiences in it that I'll touch on pretty quickly. So there was this 4x4 mat that you're standing on. And one of the experiences when I put on this, it sort of went through this cycle of different experiences. Some of them they built, some of them were built by other companies. And one of them was, you're standing on top of this very film noir setting city, and it's nighttime, and you're on top of this really high tower. And you can look over the edge and look down to the street below, and you're hundreds of feet in the air, hundreds of floors in the air. And at one point, I was like, oh, I'm going to try to walk around. So you can walk around the perimeter of this building, because you can, you're being tracked with the actual camera that's in the room. And I thought it was really cool. But I slipped on this 4x4 mat.
Oh, no.
And fell. And I instinctively went to go reach for this railing that is in the game and clearly is not in reality.
And it kind of freaked me out for a second. I was like, geez, like it really messed me up for a second. I thought it was really cool. Some other stuff. One of the experiences I thought was amazing was you're in this room and it looks like a museum and you're in a long hallway and I look over and I see this poster for a T-Rex. So it looks like a museum, like the Chicago Museum, for example. And all of a sudden you start hearing thumping. And from down the hallway, you see this giant T-Rex walk into frame. And then it walks right up to you. And because it's motion tracking, it knows where you are. So it knows where to stop, for example. And it starts sniffing the air and it gives you the, side eyeball like in Jurassic Park. And the first time I tried it, I was like, if I move, is this thing going to actually eat me? Because it does track your motion. Instead, he just sack tapped you because he walked over your head. And that was a little awkward. But and then the last one, though, was made by Epic in Unreal Engine 4. And it's a slow motion, very Gears of War-ish combat sequence where these guys are fighting this giant mechanical spider. So I guess John Peters wrote this. And they're shooting at this thing and the camera's just moving forward so you can walk around. But all of the characters on screen look life size. So they're about the same size as I am. And you can walk up to these guys as they're firing their weapons and look at the detail on their guns. You can read serial numbers on their weapons. You can look at all of the pieces that are a part of their suits. There's one element where a bomb goes off and a car flips over your head and you can look up and there are people inside of the car screaming for their dear lives. And this is all happening in slow motion. And then you get to the end of it where you are standing in front of this mechanical spider and it slow motion turns off and it just it goes right into your face. And it kind of startled me at first. So really impressive technologies that they're doing. They also have Gear VR, which is the Samsung cell phone mobile VR stuff, which I thought was pretty cool. But yeah, it was just I'm really looking forward to not playing that at press events anymore. I would like for them to come out with a retail product.
They say Crescent Bay next summer, right?
Well, they haven't said exactly when. I'm hoping it's gonna happen within a year from now. But you would assume that Crescent Bay is not going to be a new dev kit that they're releasing. So there's no DK3. There won't be a new DK3. But they say Crescent Bay is closest to a retail product as they've come. So it's really impressive. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, that's awesome. I too am very excited. I feel like to some extent, though, and obviously, we're in it's pre-production, but so many of these demos and like the eValkyrie and stuff like that, they have so many awesome snippets of things. And that thing with the spider you're talking about sounds awesome. But I am a little concerned about not even VR fatigue in the sense of, wearing the headset for too long, but just repeating awesome, right? Game designers often talk about you find your moments of cool and you find ways to repeat them, and that kind of is what you build your game around. And I just don't know if you can have moments like that spider interaction over and over and over again with it feeling fresh and not feeling stale. I want to take one more call here, and then, of course, I'll find out where people can find you guys and follow you guys, and then we'll do our parting gifts, and then I'll pitch it off to Jeff's tabletop time that he had recorded before he left. But real quick here, this is a call from 661. What's your name? Where are you calling from? And what have you been playing?
Hi, this is Michael from Amsterdam again. What I've been playing recently, well, at least for the past 3 weeks, has been Super Smash Brothers on my Japanese import system. And this past week, I also actually got Hyrule Warriors, which is pretty good considering that it's been really rough at work. So it's great to come home to something that you can basically zone out to and play.
So on a scale of awesome to not awesome, how would you rank both Hyrule Warriors, easy for me to say, and Smash on your Japanese 3DS?
Well, Smash obviously is way more awesome than I actually thought it could be on a handheld. It just really plays well. And with Hyrule Warriors, it's good. It's not bad. It's just fun. It's just mindless fun and just wailing on tons of dudes and just being a total badass.
Yeah, well, that's all you can ask for sometimes. Thanks for calling in again. Always fun to Man, I love people too that have Japanese 3DSs, and that's what I love about gaming so much is that there still is, as much as it is worldwide releases, and those are, but I do love the import scene and different games in different regions and stuff like that. For me, my playlist is kind of bare, unfortunately. I was in Salt Lake City at a comedy festival, so I brought my 3DS with me, and I was playing Zelda because I still have yet to finish it. It's still great, still highly recommend the game, but I'm still plugging through it, but I do like, in terms of Zelda games go, for people that are maybe on the fence to dive into a Zelda game on a handheld, it's very pick-up and playable. And I think part of that is, as you're sure you've heard by now, is the way that all of the weapons are available from the get-go. And you just kind of buy them at the shop and use them. So it, for me at least, it has been easier to dive into any dungeon and not feel lost and say, where am I? What am I doing? Why do I need the boomerang right now? So I still highly recommend that game, having not finished it. Dude, Iffy, Zaf, thank you guys so much for doing the show. Iffy, you are on Twitter at Iffy's Not Funny. Anything else you want to plug? I believe you have a Seinfeld The Purge coming up at UCB. Any other shows or something you want to plug before we wrap it up here?
Yeah, Seinfeld The Purge is going to be at UCB in October. So if you're in town, definitely check that out. I'm on the new season of Key and Peele, so make sure you keep your eyes peeled for me. I mean, if you know what I look like. if you're in the New Orleans area, my short film Spinners will be screening on the 18th during the New Orleans Film Fest.
That's awesome, man. Congrats. What role or what sketch are you allowed to say what you're doing on Key and Peele so people can know what to look for specifically?
It's a continuation of the Black Republican sketch. So
awesome. Cool.
When you see those characters, I'm in that. I'm the guy, the black guy that's in there.
You play the black guy?
Yeah, I play the black guy.
Awesome. Zav, how about you?
Well, you can follow me on Twitter at XAV and also go to joystick.com. We've mentioned a couple of games like Hyrule Warriors and Smash Brothers. We have reviews for those that are up and available right now for people to read. And follow us on Twitter at joystick. We also stream constantly on Twitch, and that's twitch.tv/joystick. And that's JOYSTIQ.
Awesome. I am at Spicer on Twitter, SPICER. If you are in the Los Angeles area, our next improv versus stand-up at UCB will be on Thursday, October 9th. It is with an improv group that is amazing, whose name I can't say on the show. Crappy Jobs. We'll say Crappy Jobs. Think of the expletive for crappy. it's DC Pearson, Dominic Durkis, a bunch of other really funny people. Those just happen to be the two people that I am the best friends with as part of that group. And then it's going to be stand-up from, brain work. Do it. Dean Del Rey, who was on Marin. The IFC show, Marin. He also just got done doing shows on the Oddball tour. And then Jonathan Kite, who is one of the stars of Two Broke Girls. So that's Thursday, October 9th, if you are in Los Angeles. And of course, you can give this show a review on iTunes or tell people about it. That's the best thing you can do, is we love new listeners and we like hanging out with you guys. Before we pitch to Jeff's tabletop time, parting gifts, one little thing, maybe not video game related at all. Zav D'Amatos, what is your parting gift?
Not video game related and probably works well with tabletop, but I've been playing a lot of board games lately. And my current favorite, I think, is something that's been brought up on the show, which is Dead of Winter, which is by Plaid Hat Games. And it is absolutely fantastic. If you can find a copy, because it's still quite hard to find in your friendly local game store or online even, get a chance to get it, pick it up. It's a fantastic game. And another quick gift for everyone is, if you have questions and concerns about how Steam curation works, we have a great editorial written by Mike Suzek on Joystick, and it's called Opening the Valve, Steam Curators Rule the Front Page, where we talk to them and we talk about some of the questions and concerns that have come up in the last week since it has gone live. So check that out on joystick.com.
Hey, that sounded a lot like a video game thing there at the end, Zav.
It's more of a video game distribution platform than a video game proper.
Got it. Iffy, what's your parting gift?
My parting gift is to go ahead and check out check out the newest season of Key and Peele, Brie and Dates. I wrote it down last night so I wouldn't forget, and I like that I did include Brie and Dates. It's a new, if you haven't tried it, buy some Brie, some Dates, eat them together, and you're in for quite a treat.
Do you spread it on bread or just Brie on a date and then in your mouth?
Yeah, Brie on a date in your mouth. Watch out for those seeds.
Awesome. Well, that's a great parting gift if there ever was one. Mine is going to be reminding people that may or not know that Thor number one is out or should be out. It hits shelves. Depending on when you're listening to this, it is out and it is, you know, female Thor. They are continuing that story. If you read the Thor books, there is a big shakeup going on and that continues. I think Thor number one leaves a little bit to be desired initially, but I think it's a great launching pad for where the series will go. I hope that it is more than just a year-long gimmick to sell books. That said, I'm telling you, buy the book, right? I'm part of the problem. Buy the book. It's interesting. It's well done. Thor 1 is coming out or is out now, depending on when you are listening to this. Iffy and Zav, thank you both again so much. With that, until next week, for me, think about what you put out into the world and make it a better place. And now, Jeff Cannata with an awesome tabletop time segment. We're done.
It's another week, and I'm still in Italy on my honeymoon. Hopefully, Spicer hasn't completely ruined the show yet. I'm imagining Christian Spicer's Vita and Cynicism hour. But he did suggest, actually, that tabletop time could just be just a half an hour of him sitting in silence, as he actually does every week. But no, I am here to talk board games, and I have myself an awesome guest. You guys have heard me describing my Risk Legacy campaign, the epic campaign that we've been doing for weeks and weeks with my gaming group. And I'm so pleased to welcome the designer of Risk Legacy, as well as dozens and dozens of other excellent games, including Betrayal at House on the Hill and the upcoming Seafall. I have Mr. Rob Davio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Rob, as you heard, I am in the middle of a Risk Legacy campaign.
Yep.
And basically the only reason I have you on the show is so that you and I can come up with rules to screw my friends.
Certainly.
Because I have been in a heated battle with one Peter Serretta from Slash Film, who is in my gaming group, and he has been camping in Australia, and he just won a big game the other night, and so I figure I could have you on the show. The whole game is about changing rules, so let's come up with some ways that I can screw him over. The thing about Risk Legacy is it's contentious, man.
Oh, I know. It's like sort of licensed anger, right?
Yeah.
Like the thing is, Risk is angry.
That's right.
Which is weird, because do you know who the original designer of Risk was? A French filmmaker in the 50s.
Sacre bleu, I'll kill you.
No, I mean, it was just like he did the Red Balloon. I can't remember. Albert Demaurice.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know.
And all of a sudden, he decided to make a game which has just caused like flipping and rage quit for 50 years now.
Yeah, and I think Risk Legacy increases that, because now the stakes are even higher, because what I do now or what you do now carries over into subsequent games. I heard you give a talk. Actually, highly recommend watching. It's very entertaining. There's a video linked to your Board Game Geek profile where you did a talk at Practice in 2012 or 13.
Last year. It actually got me a job as a professor at NYU.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, it's a fantastically entertaining talk. But you mentioned that the original idea sort of came from Clue, which is not a contentious game at all. Do you think that...
Yeah, no. Well, Clue is a game which should have more storytelling than it does.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's a murder mystery. And yet it is completely devoid of any logic to the mystery, which you certainly don't think about as a kid.
Yeah.
Like, you really don't know if someone was shot or bludgeoned
right.
or strangulated or stabbed. Like, I would think even, you know, in 1930s England, you should be able to figure that out. And if you did – and he's always found in the basement, but you have to figure out what room he was killed in. So if I stab someone in the library and drag him to the basement, like, a couple things should be pretty obvious.
That's true.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know what happened. Where did this horrible crime take place, and how was it?
Yeah, he has a gaping stab wound. You know what? Yeah. I think it was the rope. I think the rope did it.
That's the thing. There's one gun. There's like one, you know, slashing weapon. There's a couple blunt objects. So you're like, okay, wrench or candlestick. Like that's a we don't know which one.
Right. Yeah.
And then it's a game where you're walking around this house accusing each other of murder. And if you're right, you're basically accusing someone who's proven that they can kill and have in the past hour. Why won't they just kill you again? And then at the end of the game, it could be the type of thing where you go, oh, I did it, but I don't remember it because I was like all hopped up on meth or something.
Right.
And I guess it was me, and I win for figuring out my own false memories.
I will say it's remarkable that they managed to make a coherent film out of that, though, even with all those flaws. I love that movie.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just the game itself is trying to be something which it really isn't. You know, it's you know, murder mystery in the English manner and all this. And so it has all of the people fill in the blanks of what it's supposed to be, even though it isn't.
Yeah. Well, I'm so curious because I feel like that legacy concept works so well with Risk. And now you're bringing it to your own game, Seafall, but also to Pandemic, which is a cooperative game.
Yeah.
Do you think that the contentious aspect of Risk is necessary? I mean, obviously you don't, but how will you be able to sub that out for something else?
Well, Seafall is a game of exploration, mm-hmm. but it's an age of exploration, and there's ship battles and land battles. So you have that sense of very physical, visceral sort of revenge tactics. And one of the big problems I had with Seafall, I can't even say one of the big problems. I created every problem I could with Seafall, and now I'm trying to fix them, which made it about a year late. And, you know, that's my fault because I got out of Hasbro and said, I can make anything I want, so I'm going to make something so big it's unplayable.
And you succeeded in that.
I succeeded until I had to go find a developer and show him my mess and say, please help me edit this.
Well, how do you even playtest that game?
Slowly.
Yeah. Do you playtest over an iterated copy to its logical conclusion, or do you do lots of fits and starts?
It's fits and starts until it kind of gets its legs under it. And if I had to do it again, I would just make a game that I would refuse to think of anything past game one, and I would just keep playing game one like a regular board game until it really worked. And people said, "What's next?" But instead, I got really excited about the narrative and the story and the end game, and I was racing ahead. You know, yeah. I was doing like post-production before I'd written a script, and it just sort of fell apart. Like it would start out okay, and then when I'd get to like game five, it always just ended up a mess.
Yeah.
Well, so I've fixed it up and it's holding together now. Now I play once a week at my house with a group of people, and they're just – we're continuing with their game even if I'm making changes underneath them. Like they showed up last night and I'm like, the board's different, but we're going to pretend that didn't happen. It's still game five. Let's go.
Crazy. It's so fascinating to me, this process, because it's so much different, I imagine, than any other kind of playtesting. But
yeah, it is. I mean, I think it's probably designing a role playing game plus like a 12 like level adventure.
Yeah.
Same time. So you have to like make the rules, and then you have to run people through the story and make sure that the rules and the story kind of work together and the power level works out right. I'm playing a lot of Clash of Clans lately because my son plays it, and I have to like get good enough to join his clan.
Uh-huh.
So like the neighborhood kids like, what level are you? Like, no, not yet, man. Not yet. But I see a lot of parallels between like Clash of Clans and what I'm trying to do in Seafall in terms of leveling up in a logical way.
Okay. That's interesting. That's interesting. I'm one of the things I wanted to bring up with you is, you know, Fantasy Flight's XCOM game. It was sort of the big talk this year at Gen Con, and marrying these new technologies with classic board games. And one of the things that's so great about Risk Legacy is how it's so visceral, and it's using ink and, you know, tearing things up, and it's all that paper-based stuff. Are you intrigued by the possibilities of using technology in a legacy concept, or is that something that you're not as interested in?
I'm interested in it, and I have worked with things that have technologies and electronics and you know, Hasbro and the mass market companies that I still do a lot of work with. They're always trying to figure out how do we do this marriage between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And So I'm well familiar, and I have a design partner I work with more in mass market who's sort of electronics, you know, expert. And so we're always kicking it around. The issue with putting it into a legacy game is twofold, which doesn't mean I won't do it. I just have avoided it. One, these games are kind of expensive as they are, with a lot of the like handwork and envelopes and hidden compartments. And
yeah,
that would add a big cost. And the second thing, it is a game that, although I work very hard not to make them disposable, when people are done, they probably won't play it again, which isn't to say they didn't get their money's worth, right? If you play a game like 15, 16, 17 times at an hour and a half a pop, you're probably more than your regular games, but there's this real perception that like, oh, it's over.
Yeah.
And so if I put electronics in and it's something you destroy and then you have some like technology or some electronics, it just sort of perpetuates that thought of, oh, I paid all this money for this, and it's now so, I can't use it.
It seems so backwards to me, even more so, because technology is so much more disposable and quickly outdated than you know, paper and cardboard is. And I can name, I don't know, there's a dozen at least games on my shelf that I won't and haven't and will never play 15 times, but still love. But Risk Legacy, I'm dying to play it 15 times. You know, I think it's the opposite of disposable.
Well, that's what I like to think, and you're a very smart man for realizing.
Why, thank you.
It's a sense of I wanted you to have a reason to play a game multiple times and have it feel complete, like video games do. I did. I played it. You know, I went through. I enjoyed it. Cardboard is inherently cheap and disposable. I put gallons of it by the side of the road every week.
Right.
And don't think twice about it. No one ever gets upset if I, whoa, that pizza box, what are you doing? What are you doing?
Yeah, right.
But you sell it as a game and it becomes like sacred.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, one of the things that I love most about board games is just taking care of them. I get excitement on putting things in their little place and having cool, I've gotten really into like making dividers for games in the box. There's something satisfying about that. So I guess I understand the attachment that happens.
Oh, yeah. And this isn't to dismiss it, because I have hundreds of board games and all of them, by and large, are taken care of. I mean, having worked in the industry, sometimes I'm like, I need some cardboard and I'll cannibalize a game I know I'm never going to play again and has like a $2 resale value. But that took me years to get over. I think some people think because I designed Risk Legacy, I'm just sitting in a squalor of cardboard and markers and, you know, just writing on the walls of my house.
You hate permanence.
I hate permanence. Everything dies. It's all entropy. My father. No, it was more, I don't know. Is it rock and roll? Is it a punk rock moment?
For sure.
It was a little bit of saying, well, I mean, when I thought of it, I was like, well, you can't do that.
Well, I think that that's what's so profound about the idea. I mean, honestly, not to blow smoke, but I think that the legacy concept is one of the most exciting things to happen to board games in the last decades, whatever you want to say. But I feel like your name now is synonymous with that concept. Is that a curse as well as a blessing, or do you feel a burden to continue doing these types of games?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's a curse and a blessing. Like I had my hand in probably over 100 games that have gone to print. Sometimes a little bit. Sometimes creating from scratch. Sometimes just doing a refresh for Hasbro. Sometimes acting as an editor for Sunday Trivia Pursuit. And I've had some games before this that were quite well known, either as a designer or co-designer. But now I'm just known for this, which, you know, it's not bad. I could be known for worse things.
Right.
But now I will, you know, put something up on Twitter like, hey, I'm out to a restaurant. People be like, Restaurant Legacy. I'm like, well, yes, I'm going to eat the food and it will go away. But it's sort of like there's this obligation to do more of them, which is fine, but they take a long time.
Yeah.
So it would be a great way for my new company and me to kind of go out of business because I can't keep up with the demand.
Do you feel a sense of ownership over the idea, or do you want other designers to take up the mantle and run with it?
Both.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I came up with the idea, but there were a lot of people at Hasbro who I worked with and around who made it better, like with any creative project. So I both sort of like feel like I was the creator of it and sort of the shepherd of it. But some of the things that make Risk Legacy work came from my developer and my, you know, friends around Hasbro. I would love to play one. because I want to see what it's like to go through the other way. And someone else will figure out the stuff I didn't do well and make it better or come up with a new idea. And in my mind, it would be a nice ping pong back and forth. Be like, oh, that's cool. I'm going to build off of that on my next one. And it becomes like a dialogue between designers through games.
That's awesome.
And I want to be surprised. I want to see an envelope and feel what it's like to be in the audience, so to speak.
Yeah, man, you have created the first board game that has spoilers.
Yeah.
And to be the only guy on the universe who hasn't ever experienced the surprise must be a bit of a bummer.
Yeah, so I've heard off and on through the past couple of years, oh yeah, I know some people who are working on them. But it's been almost 3 years and none of them's out. And I think everyone else realized, which I should have, which they get a little ways in and go, oh, this is just a crap load of work. Like, I can make like 4 games in the time it takes to finish this. And they just kind of put it on the shelf and walk away.
That's awesome. You're like, yeah, yeah. See, everybody? See?
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the kinds of games that you like that you don't make. What are some of your favorite board games that you're playing right now that aren't yours?
Oh, this is an awkward question because I've reached that point in being an independent board game designer where I kind of just play my own. Like when I get some free time, I say to people like, hey, do you guys mind trying this? It's not quite working. And I played it by myself, which I'm not proud of. I'm not like, yeah, I only play my own stuff. I love talking to myself and just living a little echo chamber of my own ideas. But I only have so much time. And what happens is my job at Hasbro moved away a couple of years ago, which is why I don't work there. Mm-hmm. And all my gaming buddies went with it.
Interesting.
So in order for me to play board games, I got to be going in the car a significant amount of time.
Right.
Which means it's more of a scheduled event. So having said that, I tend to play like sort of casual digital games. So like my son went through a huge Minecraft phase earlier and I was programming Minecraft with him and hosting worlds.
That's awesome.
Yeah, there's a project that I was doing on it that we sort of abandoned that was like hardcore and it's like 70% done. And then he kind of outgrew Minecraft and it wasn't quite fun enough for me to do without my son. But I might want to pick that up and finish because that's something I'd like to show people and say, look what I did.
That's neat. And
as for board games, what have I played recently? I played Splendor.
Oh, I'm dying to play that. Yeah,
I really like it's one of those games that I should be designing as opposed to these legacy games because it's like King of Tokyo or something where it's casual enough where you can explain it to non-gamers or people and they go, oh, I get it.
Right.
And they play along. And it's one of those games that when you see the finished game, you go, it's so obvious. This must have taken like 20 minutes. I mean, and you know, it's not, but like it came together so tightly that you can't see all the work that went into it. What else am I playing? I'm looking over at I played Sentinels of the Multiverse, which I know is not new, but I've been meaning to play it with my family, but I really botched the rules description.
Uh-oh.
Well, I read it and I go, oh, it's like a collaborative deck building game with superheroes. Okay, let's just jump so I don't have to burden you with rules and got everyone confused. And everyone's like, Dad, this game's awful. I'm like, no. And I was like one of these bad dad moments. Like, we're playing this game. Damn it, I made you dinner. And we got done and I haven't had the courage to bring it up again because I think everyone's got a little like PTSD about the game.
Does your family, are they into the tabletop stuff? I mean, your son sounds like he's exactly like my nephews where they're, you know, Minecraft and Clash of Clans and that kind of stuff. But do they dig on the board game stuff?
Yeah, more than an average family, but I think less than people who play games as a hobby but don't do it professionally.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So if you work in another job and you've got a gaming group and you play games in the evening and it's your like sort of passion, I think your kid, you play a lot of stuff with your kids.
Mm-hmm.
It's my job.
Right.
There's two things around it. One, I don't necessarily want to push my job onto the kids, but so I do it, you know, here and there. And also I usually am at my desk by 7:30 in the morning and to work 5:30 at night. And that's about 6 days a week.
Wow.
So when the kids are around and we have dinner and it's 7, be like, you want to play a game? I'm kind of like, not really. Like, well, I kind of want to watch some baseball or to learn guitar for the 8th year running or, you know, watch Bob's Burgers. Like, we've been doing a lot of that. So if work is slow, I play more games with the kids. So the kids can talk about worker placement games and have like a mild opinion on it, which is more than people off the street. But they don't play nearly as much, I think, as like families who host board game nights.
Yeah. What does your average work day consist of? Are you sitting around just being ponderous and thinking about stuff? Are you, you know, making like mock-ups or?
Yeah, it's a little of everything. Mostly it's sort of a sweaty panic.
It sounds like my work day.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of thinking like I'm a one-man show and I've got a startup business. So I am doing everything from running to Staples to get sticker paper to looking at contracts to, you know, doing POs and answering emails. I'm also teaching a course at NYU this fall, like a graduate course in board game design.
That's awesome.
Which takes me to New York once a week, which is fun. And then I'm working on different projects at various phases. So it's a mixture of logistics and creativity. Let's see, what am I working on today? I am trying to finish the next version of Seafall to push to a group of playtesters, which I thought was done, but then I played it last night and realized, oh, I really should change these things before I send it out. Mm-hmm. So I have to dig back into that. I have two projects for Hasbro that are due Monday, one of which they gave me today at noon.
Wow.
So that'll be my weekend.
Yikes.
Which is sort of some game development. Like they have a game and they're like, can you help us sort of, you know, balance this or tighten it up?
Wow.
And write rules. I'm looking at video of Pandemic Legacy playtest sessions and taking notes on that. I just got off a call with a sort of junior developer I've hired to help me with another game I'm working on. He playtested it last night. We spent an hour going over his playtest and what we want to change. I went to the post office and dropped off Pandemic Legacy prototypes for a different group of playtesters. And I'm trying to get in touch with some people to figure out how I can sell a game into Barnes and Noble.
Wow.
So it's very sort of cool. Like that every day.
Yeah. That's awesome. I imagine there's a very few people in the world that are full-time game designers like you, like have your hand in all those different worlds, the sort of the big corporate Hasbro side, your own personal pet projects.
Yeah.
That's really, really cool. Are you able to talk at all about how Pandemic Legacy will work in any way?
Probably. You can ask some questions and let's see how delightfully elusive I can be.
Well, I mean, I'm a huge fan of Pandemic, as are most board gamers. Yeah. The idea of is it our collective wins and losses that will carry over from game to game, or are there going to be traitors that will pop up that will influence the game?
Yeah, so here's why I'm delightfully vague, but I'll give you some information. So Matt Leacock, the designer of Pandemic, I heard Gen Con 2013, so a little over a year ago, was trying to get in touch with me. So I reached out to him, and it turned out he was, you know, intrigued by putting the legacy concept to Pandemic. And I went, oh, I've thought about this, like collaborative legacy's tough because if the game starts beating the crap out of you, it doesn't know any better.
Yeah, yeah.
And
that's one of the things I love most about listening to your talk is you talking about the game as a participant or as something that should have knowledge or not have knowledge. I just love that perspective. But go ahead.
Yeah, no. And so I said, I don't know. You know, I've given it some thought and I had like a half idea. And I said, well, let's just start talking and see if we can figure it out. And I've had a great time working with Matt. And this is the work on that is really helped me on Seafall, because what I realized is, in order to make a good legacy game, you need a really pretty straightforward, simple engine for game one that you can build on. And Pandemic has a lot of decisions, but you can get people up and running pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And I still remember that time when the first time I was playing and I'm like, we had our first epidemic and we did all that stuff. And we took the discard pile and the person said, and now we shuffle it and put it back on top. And I'm like, what do you mean on top? He's like, yeah, these cards are going to come out again.
Yeah.
And like even talking about it, I'm still a little sick to my stomach. Like the feeling I had, like, are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh, and it was like this moment of like revulsion and deep respect for coming up with that idea. So anyway, we started talking and I can say that game one is fairly close to Pandemic. There are a couple things that are a little different, but if you played Pandemic and you pick up Pandemic Legacy and you start playing game one, you'll be like, oh, it's like Pandemic, but, you know, the win conditions are – no, actually, the win conditions are the same. Yeah, there's just like a few little things that you have to add on.
That's kind of like, how Risk Legacy is too. It's like – it's basically Risk.
Right. And it's basically – if you've played Risk and Risk Legacy, it's basically the same thing where you're like, oh, I see how it's different.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get going. And then It goes from there. I mean, what's different, and I think this is all, I'm going to try to just stick to stuff that's public, is the game starts in like January, and you play through December.
Ah, interesting. Okay, that sounds cool.
So there's a sense of, you know, the game is progressing, and you just have to sort of hang on and stay on top of it. So it's really kind of like surfing.
Wow.
Right? The wave's just going, and you're just like, just stay with it, stay with it. And what we discovered with playtesters and is people are kind of treating this like Netflix. Like,
oh, really?
Football takes like 2 hours to play, uh-huh. You know, and maybe and so it's like this big epic game, and Pandemic Legacy is like 45 minutes to an hour. And so people will sit down and binge play.
Yeah.
Right? They'll sit down like, oh, let's play one. And they get to go, oh, one more.
Yeah.
It's April. What happens in April? And so we'll give a game out to a playtest group. And we're like, okay, you have like 3 or 4 weeks and give us your notes and video stuff. And we'll ask you questions. And like a week later, they're like, done.
That's awesome.
And we're like, wow, okay, thank you. They're like, yeah, we sat down to play 2 games and we played 7.
Well, that's kind of how we've been playing Risk Legacy also, because, you know, you get to the end of one and you're like, oh, my God, I want revenge on you. I want to kill you. And you also are excited about what could happen. And, oh, my God, we were so close to opening a packet to this time and we could do it next time. And there's so many wonderful carrots on sticks that way, too.
I try to – part of the reason you open packets at the end of the game and you make these decisions at the end of the game is to deliberately create discussion and cliffhangers, which make you want one more.
Yeah, that's certainly effective.
Yeah, so you put down like some minor cities here and you do this and we open this and this just came in and you're sitting there with your friends and you're like, I want to see how this works out now.
Yeah.
We should play again, right? And that was like an attempt to try to create episodic board gaming and treat it like episodes where you have to end one episode with one more.
Yeah, with a cliffhanger. And, yeah, it's so true. Yeah,
and Matt and I, when we're doing Pandemic, we talk about 50% about pacing and plotting and cliffhangers and narrative and theme, and 50% about the mechanics to implement them.
Is there any other game out there that you think would be a great legacy candidate?
Yeah, I mean, I have a category, which is a game – I mean, I figured it out. It's a game that's pretty straightforward to play, relatively short, and could you – has theme but could use more.
Like Dominion Legacy? That sounds like it hits all those notches right there.
Yeah, I mean, you could basically do a deck-building game where the decks do carry on or they don't reset fully back to start.
Yeah.
I kind of had that in Seafall in a way, and I didn't do a good job with it, I think it was because that wasn't the game. It was part of a much larger game when I said I made it too big. So I ran away like it was a car on fire. But I think it could be done. Yeah, I mean, Dominion has next to no theme.
Right.
At no point do I say, look at my vast holdings as a medieval overlord.
Right, right. Yeah.
I'm just trying to think of what. Well, I'm just looking at my shelf here. Mice and Mystics kind of does that same thing. It's episodic storytelling.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just in a different way. But I don't know. I mean, I don't have anything on my shelf that right now that everything tends – looking behind me is a little Euro. Mm-hmm. And, you know, being a Euro game, a lot of times it's going to be mechanics over theme.
Right.
And – the very nature of a legacy game is just so American. Like, yeah, hey, this is going to get crazy. Grab something. It's happening. Like, let's just – and I think – well, Risk Legacy bombed in Germany.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
There was a version that was put out in Germany. It didn't do well. And one reason is – and I heard this. I can't confirm it, that at Essen, the publisher took the game, opened it up, every packet, laid it all on the table and talked – through everything you get in the game.
Oh, no.
And I was like, I heard that after. I'm like, that's not what you do here.
Oops.
If you saw it, I mean, it's a big shaggy mess when it's all taken out. It's about the process of opening these.
Right. Sure. Yeah. Crazy. Well, man, it's been awesome talking to you. As I said, I'm a huge fan of what you're doing and what you have done. We didn't even get a chance to talk about Betrayal at House on the Hill, which is a fantastic game. And is there any hope for either of these games in 2014? The
No, neither of them will be 2014. Neither are scheduled, but at some point I need to be done these sooner rather than later. So I'm shooting for next year on both, but I've learned really not to give a firm date now until pretty much the thing's on a boat.
Yeah. And even then, man, boats are sinkable. That's crazy.
But at least then I could say the boat sank. Not I messed right. it up. I mean, I made that mistake with Seafall. It's like, I have my own company. I'm doing my own game that I own for the first time in my life. And I shouted out and I announced it like a year too early.
Yeah.
And then, rookie mistake. And now I'm like, sorry. And this industry is great because every time I say people are like, oh, is it going to be this year? And I'm like, no, it got big. It's going to be next year. And everyone's like, that's okay. Take your time. Make it right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great community.
Yeah. Thank you, gamers. And I've been on other podcasts and this one podcast I do pretty regularly. And I've been sort of griping about when I've been stuck in design and gamers have been sending me emails like with suggestions and are you okay? And do you need play testers?
It's awesome. That's one of the things that I say all the time is that part of the reason I love board games so much is the people who play them. They are generally fantastic people and it's a fun community to be a part of.
Yeah, it's great. I'm just thrilled that I can eke out a living in it.
Well, I can't wait to play Seafall and Pandemic Legacy, and I'm halfway through this Risk Legacy campaign, and it's so exciting and so much fun. So thank you for being on the show, and thanks for making those games.
Yeah, no problem. Have fun in Italy, even though when this is heard, you're there.
Yeah. Time travel's hard, man.
That's really weird. My head hurts.
Is there any thing you'd like to plug, any place you'd like to send our listeners if they're interested in finding out more about your stuff?
I'm pretty active on Twitter. It's at Rob Davio Gamer, so RobDaviau Gamer. That's where you can usually find out what I'm working on and what gets announced.
Awesome. Thanks again, man. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks. Bye.
Bye.